Hello and welcome to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On this week's show, the good folk of Utah are readying themselves for a British invasion as our finest filmmakers and stars head west to this year's Sundance Film Festival.
You know, over the years, the British film industry has really perfected the technique of making films that have a voice and a spark to them, but on a smaller budget.
Yes, Observer writer Armando Iannucci premieres his debut feature In the Loop at Sundance alongside a host of British talents, more of which later. Currently starring with Daniel Craig in Defiance, that superb American actor Liev Schreiber talks roots and babies, and Zan Brooks joins me to review Mickey Rourke in The Wrestler, Catherine Deneuve in The Grip of a Dysfunctional Family in A Christmas Tale, and Ingrid Bergman stars with Cary Grant in the reissued Notorious. Yes, if you want a hold on the world film scene, you just gotta listen to Film Weekly. Hailed by many critics as one of the finest stage actors of his generation, American star Liev Schreiber is pretty handy on screen too. He's currently giving a muscular, confident performance opposite Daniel Craig and Jamie Bell in the Jewish resistance drama Defiance. But he's also appeared in films such as The Manchurian Candidate, The Painted Veil, and Kate and Leopold, as well as comedy indie classic The Day Trippers. He also made a striking, weird directorial debut with an adaptation of Jonathan Safran Foer's Everything is Illuminated, a film which took him to his ancestral roots of Lithuania. When I met up with Liev, I asked him if being in Belarusia for Defiance was treading on familiar ground.
I think Defiance was another in a series of jobs that is I think, to some degree, exploring my own heritage. I think ever since my grandfather passed, I've been curious about that, you know, Eastern European aspect of my history. And so I got to spend some time in Vilnius.
So, I mean, you can never escape that, I'm assuming, because of your name. You know, it's just going to be part of you, whatever you do.
Yeah, my mother ensured that for me. I think my mom was always a big Russian lit fan. Hence the Tolstoy derivative.
Yeah. So, I mean, is there? I know when we spoke about Everything is Illuminated, that you felt the shadows of your ancestors there with you. Is it the same for Defiance? Do you feel when you're doing a story that is very intimately related to your own bloodstream that you're kind of reviving or following steps that they might have trod?
You know, it's funny because I don't think that. For me, I'm feeling anything as much as I'm sort of looking for something. That I think that I'm, trying things on. I think that's one of the fun things about being an actor is that you get to explore elements of life and your own. In my case, in your own history and heritage, I did see similarities, particularly between the character of Zush and my own grandfather. Probably more so than I did on Everything is Illuminated. But I think I was so close creatively to the process of Everything is Illuminated that it was harder to see. Mm.
So it strikes me that your character, Zush, of all of them, is the most kind of action-led. I mean, he's what my grandfather would have called a starker. You know, he kind of gets involved. With your grandfather, because it strikes me that you're probably more a man of intellect, a Malbushim rather than the one.
But Malbushim. Yes. I love that people think that about me. If only it were true. No, I love the simplicity of Zush, and I sort of long for that kind of the character for a long time. Play a very direct, physical character. And I really, really have to say that I enjoyed it, and I think that for the rest of my life, I'm going to do that. I'm going to be the Starker from now on. I've had enough of the Malbushim.
When you did your Hamlet, though, he was more—he was a thinking Hamlet rather than an active Hamlet, wasn't he?
Well, I'm hard pressed to really find a Hamlet that isn't a thinking Hamlet. I know that people talk about active Hamlets, that there are Hamlets that aren't thinkers. I'd really love to see that performance.
I think it was Mel Gibson's one, wasn't it, in the film?
It was actually, which I thought was an excellent one. Yeah, I was a very, but I think that was Zeffirelli, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
He does. He has a real way with making that stuff active. He did the same thing I thought with Romeo and Juliet.
Let's talk about going the actual filming of Defiance, which seemed to be, you know, one always talks about grueling film sets, and I always think, well, it can't be that bad because actors, they have nice trailers and their agents are around. And this one actually looked a bit cold, I have to say.
It was very cold, and Ed did something incredibly shrewd. He parked the trailers a good quarter of a mile away from where we were actually shooting. So you sort of had to make this frozen trek back to your trailer if you wanted some respite from the cold. And he guessed it right, because what we did instead was sort of huddle together and work on that sense of ensemble and camaraderie that I think it was important for the characters to have.
You're talking to men of action, you're obviously acting with Daniel Craig and James Bond. Mm. Did he ever talk about playing the world's most famous secret agent? I think he's terrific in this film as well, shows a great range. Mm-hmm. But did you two ever discuss that kind of, because given the film is about ethics and action and mm-hmm. nobility versus action, did he discuss those thoughts in a Bond context?
No, we didn't talk about Bond much at all, actually. But any time that there was physical action, I would always sort of watch to see how Daniel would do it first, because I knew he had the moves. I think, he's surprisingly unlike his character. Well, I was very happy to see that. Is really at heart a very generous kind of fun guy.
Yeah. And I have to congratulate you just before we go, Liev, on a new child. You and Naomi Watts have just had another baby.
Samuel Kai Schreiber was born on December 17th, and it's fantastic.
You must be missing him.
I am, but I'm grateful for the extra sleep I've been getting.
Yeah. Liev, lovely to see you. Mazel tov.
Good to see you. Thank you.
Back in the Whiz Bang Guardian Film Studios, I'm joined by Zan Brooks for our hot review section. Welcome back, Zan.
Thank you very much.
Golden Globes, did you stay up late? Matchsticks pinned to
your kind of more got up early. I don't know if that shows I kind of put more weight on the Oscars than the Globes.
Yeah, well, that's right to do so, isn't it? We stay up late through the Oscars. I shall hold your hand through them again this
Please
year,
do.
I hope. A good set of results, though, I thought, across the
I
board.
I thought it was a pretty good set of results. It was obviously a very good night for Slumdog Millionaire. It was a great night for Kate Winslet, who won not one but two awards and didn't get great reviews for her speeches.
No, but anyway, she's unpracticed at those because, as she says, she never wins.
She never wins nothing.
Like, okay, is she going to win at the Oscars too?
I think she goes into it as the heavy favourite. I mean, people always say about the Globes, oh, now we know where the Oscars are going, and it doesn't always work out that way. It didn't work out that way last year, so it remains to be seen whether it will, but I think that she's certainly the favourite, and I guess Slumdog is the favourite for best film.
I think Oscar voters have got a bit wise to this. They kind of go, actually, if the Globes vote for it, we're going to vote against it.
There's certainly a kind of a traditional reaction that goes on, that we're not following where you lead, and maybe they kind of get a bit perverse like that.
Yeah, so I'm wondering if Mickey Rourke, who won the Best Actor for his performance in The Wrestler, might win at the Oscars. I've got a feeling he will. Let's talk about the film The Wrestler. We're going to talk about The Wrestler. We're going to talk about Ingrid Bergman's season and, of course, Notorious at BFI South. But we're going to talk about the Christmas Tale. We're also going to talk about Chadney Chowk to China. I know people are slathering at the mouth, wanting to know what that is. But let's start with Mickey Rourke, who won the Golden Globe for Best Actor. In this comeback role, he won at Venice as well. The film won at Venice. It's called The Wrestler, Darren Aronofsky's new film. After the kind of debacle that was The Fountain, but after the successes that were Pi and Requiem for the Dream, here's Aronofsky back on indie soil with The Wrestler as Mickey Rourke gets one last shot at glory.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
That's okay. When was it?
A couple of weeks ago.
Oh, how are you feeling?
I don't feel like Hercules.
What happened?
I just was walking in the dress room and the guys told me I just dropped like a brick and I don't remember nothing. Well, now the doctors tell me that I can't wrestle no more.
What are you gonna do?
I just don't feel right. And that's why I wanted to talk to you. Because I don't want to be alone.
It's a dream part. And it's a bit of a kind of comeback role for all concerned. You're saying Aronofsky needed to kind of have a hit after The Fountain. Mickey Rourke hasn't had a hit since like the late 1980s. And the other main actor in it, Marissa Tomei, hasn't had a hit for a long time.
Since she won the Oscar for her first
outing. My Cousin Vinny.
Yeah. The talking of awards, apparently she's not supposed to have won that. That her name wasn't on. They read out the wrong name. That's the rumour that persists, that someone read out the wrong name.
Well, again, that's so wonderfully tragic and appropriate for this film, which is all about kind of lost dreams and last shots of glory. And and people who really haven't kind of fulfilled their promise.
Yeah, so he's an 80s wrestler who kind of used to be big when Hulk Hogan was big. You can kind of get the feeling that he's kind of emulating Hulk Hogan with that flowing mane hair.
Yeah, and she's a sort of an aging stripper. And I think Aronofsky very cleverly and perhaps even cynically kind of plays on the iconography of these fading stars that, you know, and there is a kind of weird parallel perhaps that he's suggesting between acting, wrestling and stripping.
Yeah.
That, you know, these people are all slightly bit past their best and they're having to do things that maybe, you know, aren't totally dignified for them. So Rook is kind of slumming around and climbing into the tanning salon and getting his hair done at a boutique and things like that. And, you know, Marissa Tomei has to kind of pole dance and stick her rear at the camera in a way that maybe she wouldn't have accepted this role 10 years ago.
Yeah, so I it's interesting that you say that's a cynical sort of exploitation of them.
Is it perhaps
like talking about people who have to jump through undignified hoops to make a living, to keep their careers
Absolutely.
Going?
Absolutely. And the film, for all that potential cynicism about it, does have a heart and did totally convince me, particularly in its view of the wrestling circuit. Now, this is obviously a real kind of slice of American grotesque, and the film doesn't shy away from that. And yet, at the same time, it doesn't make it into this kind of surreal nightmare, and it doesn't condescend to the people who are involved in it. The wrestlers are very supportive of each other. The fans are a bunch of kind of, you know, twitching nerds. But there's a kind of heart and an enthusiasm to them too.
Yeah, I was a big fight fan myself back in the 80s, I have to say. Back in the 70s, I suppose.
It was more boxing for you though, wasn't it?
I love boxing. That's proper. That's not fixed. Yeah. The fight game. I love all that. But I like the fixedness of the wrestling, the booing at Brent Town Hall, the unmasking
the whole
of Kendo
kind of,
Nagasaki.
Yeah, the sort of pantomime show business of it all, which this film really captures without laughing at.
Yeah, I found it a very humane film. Mm. A very kind of heartfelt, very thoughtful film. And I was surprised. I wasn't expecting that when I heard about the film. I thought it was going to be a bit more show. It's very grainy and gritty and kind of reality, you know, in that very indie fashion that you don't really see very much from
No, it's not. It's a real old style of indie film. There's a little bit of Raging Bull in there. There's a little bit of On the Waterfront. It has that kind of coarse-grained quality. And you could perhaps even say it's got a bit of Rocky thrown in there too, in that it is corny. It is a corny film, and yet it completely sweeps you up in its corniness, and you believe every moment of it.
Yeah, but there's something very real to the locations as well. I mean, there's drugs involved. There's kind of a seediness.
Trailer parks and you know, the Mickey Rourke character, the Ram, you know, he only wrestles on the weekend now. That, you know, the rest of the time he's kind of in a supermarket working behind the deli counter.
Yeah, where he serves used up pieces of meat, which,
yes,
of course, he's
there
all
you
of
go,
his
the
as
little
well.
Allegory there. So, no, it's a film that does know what it's doing, and it completely, you know, I bought it. I totally bought it. I thought the last scene, I thought, now we're going for a real cheesy payoff here. This is where it's going to kind of, you know, lose its way and just take the easy route. And then at the last moment, it doesn't, and it goes out with this kind of weird existential kind of frisson where there's kind of nobody there. And he looks up into the wings, and where you think the person who should be there is going to be there, they're not.
Ooh, yeah.
And it's even an open ending.
We don't quite know.
No, we don't. We can kind of guess.
We can only guess. We can ask the characters. In fact, people have been asking Mickey Rourke when I don't think he knows the ending. As an actor, you kind of have an idea of your own answer. But I think the fact that it's left up to your interpretation is really what the film's about, isn't it?
And it's also got a great sense of mortality to it. I mean, you know, this is a big brawny hulk of a man, but he's also got the hearing aid, he's got the spectacles, he's got a heart bypass scar on his chest, and there's a terrible kind of corporeal sort of vulnerability to this film as well that I think makes it what it is.
Yeah, and his piercings, or his kind of wounds, are kind of matched by the piercings of Marissa Tomei, who, I must say, at one point we see an awful lot of.
We do see an awful lot of her.
I mean, I was quite shocked. I mean, I think she looks fantastic if that's all her own work, but a tremendously, I would say, brave in this instance.
It's literally a naked performance.
Yeah. Hmm. I don't know if we needed to see that as much of her as we did, but I'm very proud. She's not getting as many sort of, you know, award mentions as he is, it seems.
And it's, I think, more of an obviously cliched role. It's the kind of stripper with a heart of gold.
Yeah, I don't want to see Meryl Streep do it, though.
That could be next. If Meryl Streep, you know, has a run of bad luck, she could well be in a film
like
this.
It's a real Mamma Mia. That's The Wrestler, Zan, which you and I both like quite a lot. Let's move to France, Zan, for The Christmas Tale, or Un Conte de Noël. What a cast has been assembled here. Mathieu Amalric, Catherine Deneuve, Hippolyte Girardot, Chiara Mastroianni, the great and the good of France gathering for one last Christmas at the Mater Familius' house in the rundown northern area of France.
Cette maison appartient à mon mari. Il en a hérité le jour de notre mariage et nous y avons vécu depuis.
Yes, she's suffering from leukemia. One of her children needs to be the bone marrow transplant. Which one of it will in this competitive sibling Christmas here?
Yeah, well, that is one of the questions that this film asks. And this film asks a lot of questions.
Doesn't it, Jack?
It's more questions than answers here. But this is still the kind of film that the French do so well. This is a sort of impressionistic, dysfunctional ensemble family drama, a real little hothouse acting masterclass.
So well do the French do an ensemble piece that we use the French word to describe.
We do, They corner the market on ensemble dramas, I think, literally.
It's kind of Altman-esque, isn't it? It reminded me a bit of Altman's, like, The Wedding, for example, but it's done with such French Gallic sort of smoking and pouting and dysfunctionality, kind of Woody Allen meets Robert Altman. It's directed, of course, by Arnaud Desplechin, a director who I don't always like, but really liked here.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, he's not scared to sort of jumble the tones a bit. You know, other people going into this film would say, it's a family drama, therefore it's downbeat, or it's a family comedy, so therefore it's all light and frothy. And he kind of like leaps around between the tones. And I think that is sort of foxed a lot of people. I remember when this played at Cannes, It really did split the audience.
Yes,
a lot of people just thought it was a mess.
I know. I kept saying, everyone goes, the favourites of this. And I was like, but what about Winter, you know, it's a Christmas Tale? It's really, really good. They're like, shut up, Jace. You just like French films, whatever happens in there. But this one I really thought was tight. And I noticed that the American critics, the New York film critics, kept naming it in their top 10, that they absolutely went down a storm in New York. And less so, I think, in France, and less so here, perhaps. But I mean, I'm rather fond of it. I think it's witty and acerbic and bitter all at the same time.
Yeah, and it has that weird thing that it touches on some very harsh issues, and there's a lot of pain here, and yet they're all kind of smiling through it. And I think that kind of confuses people. People are looking at the actors' faces to take a clue of what response they're supposed to be giving back. And here, Desplechin is very knowingly playing with that and kind of keeping us slightly on the back foot all the time, that you're not quite sure where this is going and where the revelations are going to come and then how people are going to react to it.
Yeah, back in the summer, we had Olivier Assayas on the phone on Film Weekly about his film Summer Hours, which had a French family gathering at a dying matriarch's house. It was a bit more countryfied, a bit more bourgeois. This one you expect to be a kind of nice bourgeois, but actually the house is a complete clutter, a jumble in a horrible place called Roubio, which is actually where Desplechin grew up.
It's
a sort
not
of place,
a love letter to his hometown.
It really is
it?
Not, is it? You don't want to be moving there.
But this did really work for me. And it's incredibly long, and yet it doesn't feel long. It's very kind of light on its toes all the way through. And it throws in all those kind of French new wave ticks. It has the sort of the freeze frames and the jump cuts and things like that. And so it's very, very playful. Even though the actual subject matter may be kind of dour and hard going, it has a sort of effervescence to it.
Yeah, I can't remember a time when it effervescent, Zan. That's A Christmas Tale, starring Catherine Deneuve. Let's move on to another luminous screen presence, slightly older. The Ingrid Bergman season is upon us at BFI Southbank. They're celebrating by re-releasing Alfred Hitchcock's 1946 thriller Notorious, with her and Cary Grant flying down to Rio to invade Claude Rains' evil band of Nazi refugees. Let's have a little listen of Cary Grant, Ingrid Bergman in action at the races in Rio.
Are you betting on this race?
No.
Alex is number 10 is sure to win. He knows the owner.
Thanks for the tip.
Alex says they have been holding him back all season.
I can't help recalling some of your remarks about being a new woman. These isn't buttercups, wasn't it?
You idiot. What are you sore about? You knew very well what I was doing.
Did I?
You could have stopped me with one word, but no, you couldn't. You threw me at him.
I threw you at nobody.
Didn't you tell me to go ahead?
A man doesn't tell a woman what to do. She tells herself. You almost had me believing in that little hokey-pokey miracle of yours, that a woman like you could ever change her spots.
Oh, you're rotten.
That's why I didn't try to stop you. The answer had to come from you.
I see. Some kind of love test.
That's right.
Well, you never believed in me anyways. What's the difference?
Lucky for both of us, I didn't. It wouldn't have been pretty if I believed in you. If I'd figured she'd never be able to go through with it, she'd been made over by love.
If you only once had said that you loved me, what would have
Listen, you chalked up another boyfriend, that's all. No harm done.
I hate you.
There's no occasion to. You're doing good work. Number 10's out in front. Looks as if Sebastian knows how to pick him.
Zan, as with Hitchcock, so much going on the surface and so much going on underneath.
Yeah, I actually think this is one of my very, very favourite Hitchcocks. I mean, it's not as obviously shocking as Psycho. It's not as kind of, you know, high-gloss entertainment like North by Northwest or as complex as Vertigo. But I think that this really is a brilliant film. It's a sort of dark, nasty, but at the same time sort of mainstream World War II espionage thriller.
You talked about the French New Wave just before in relation to A Christmas Tale. François Truffaut's favourite Hitchcock film was Notorious as well. The
man of good taste, I think.
You see, you and François.
Me and François, but weirdly not my dad. I remember watching this with my dad, and he really disliked it because he said, I mean, basically, it's almost a love triangle drama between Cary Grant, Ingrid Bergman, and Claude Rains, who's the sort of the Nazi stooge that she has to marry to kind of get the secrets from. And my dad's problem with it was the Claude Rains character was much more sympathetic for him than the Cary Grant figure, and he thought that weakened the film. And actually, I think that's the film's strength.
Yes,
we know Cary Grant as, you know, the absolute epitome of the charmer, dashing, kind of gallant hero. And here, he's a nasty piece of work.
Isn't he? I think he's kind of, I love the, it seems that sort of post-war, pre-Cold War realpolitik going on, in that these people are kind of torn between love and duty. Like, Ingrid Bergman doesn't really want to sleep with Claude Rains, really want to marry, because his mum's a chew cigars and she's clearly a Nazi piece of work. But Cary Grant doesn't really want to give her up either. But at the same time,
he can't admit what he feels for her, and thus a great kind of chain of events is set in motion.
It's a very tight film. It's a very kind of claustrophobic film in a way. There's not great vistas. The Rio backdrops are kind of, it's not City of God, let's put it that way. They're kind of painted on, and there's lots of back projection. And there's a marvellous, you know, early on with Ingrid Bergman drunk and driving terribly.
Yes, spinning the wheel like crazy while the road stays sort of straight behind her in the back projection. But I do love this film so much. And there's a sort of weird bit of trivia as well, that the MacGuffin in this film was all spinning around these bottles that were containing uranium that the Nazis were trying to enrich to make the bomb. Now, when the film was made, this wasn't widely known, that this is how you made bombs, and the FBI were very alarmed by this film and actually apparently kept Hitchcock under surveillance for years afterwards, because they thought that he knew stuff that he didn't, whereas in fact he just kind of happened upon it.
They tracked him with a load of birds with a kind of radio transmitters in that used to congregate outside his window. That's how he got the idea, I think. I may be embellishing the truth there.
I think print the legend.
It is. Is it wrong? Can I ask a question? Is it wrong? I mean, Ingrid Bergman, really, really attractive in this
Why
film.
Would that ever be wrong?
Sexy. I fancy her. Is it wrong to fancy Ingrid Bergman?
Not at all.
No.
I think it might be wrong if you're fancying Ingmar Bergman. But Ingrid Bergman, I think it's absolutely fine. But, you know, let's square the circle here a bit and say that, you know, Cary Grant is a very attractive man as well.
Yeah, I mean, that's, yeah, exactly. Something for everyone.
It's something for everyone in this film. Notorious. And, you know, for my dad, he liked Claude Rains.
Yeah, he's very suave in it. Claude Rains actually got the only Oscar for this film, and he was actually brilliant as the suave
absolutely
Nazi. I like the sympathetic Nazi here, because he's still, you know, he's still part of an evil cabal.
Nazi more than I like Kate Winslet in The Reader, put it that
there
way.
There you go, exactly. Moving on from Notorious, let's just, there's a phenomena has occurred this week in that the Warner Brothers, mighty US studio, has made a Bollywood film and a Chinese film, a martial arts Bollywood musical comedy called Chadney Chowk to China. You and I sat through this. Why?
Why? I guess because it's history in the making, and that's perhaps the only thing that it does have going for it. This is Warner's kind of attempt to get in bed with the Indian film industry and get a piece of the pie. I guess it's an industry that's worth something like $10 billion a year, and yet Hollywood films barely have a look in over in the subcontinent. So it makes business sense. I watched this and I kind of, obviously Bollywood purists would say this is a terrible thing, you know, Hollywood getting involved in this. But actually, I was watching it thinking, I wish that Hollywood had actually interfered in this a little bit more. This sort of Bollywood film does not work for me. I can't read it.
Is it funny?
It's not funny, but
so
it's
basically
trying to be funny.
One of the biggest stars in the world, Akshay Kumar, who is huge in quite a few ways, it seems to me. He is a kind of useless...
He looks like Borat.
Doesn't he?
He's with a his little strapping moustache. Figure,
He's a street vendor who gets mistaken for the ancient Chinese warrior, has to go to the Great Wall of China and rescue a kind of an oppressed village. I couldn't work out if it was funny, if I was supposed to be laughing at the dance sequences.
Well, you are. You're meant to be laughing. There's comedy in there, there's action in there, there's romance, there's song and dance spectaculars. And I kind of think that all of this becomes confusing to a Western audience. And that's possibly our limitation, that we like our genres to be slightly ring-fenced and predictable.
This is why we like Slumdog Millionaire and, say, Monsoon Wedding, and Saturday at Ray, I suppose, because they're not this Bollywood genre that we have a difficulty getting
ahead. Well, exactly. This is the thing that Bollywood's always struggled with, that there is an audience for foreign language produce over in England, but that tends to be among the kind of the white middle class who want to see a Satyajit Ray film. Bollywood is unashamedly mainstream and big and broad and primary coloured, and the people who like those films are going to go and see a Bruce Willis film. They're not going to go and see a Bollywood film.
Yeah, I found the odd mix of Chinese martial arts and Bollywood dancing very strange, but I like the story of this kind of ne'er-do-well street vendor who's a bit paunchy and has to discover his inner hero through learning martial arts a Chinese master. Do you know what I was thinking? I think they should have called it Kung Fu Passanda.
Kung Fu Passanda is probably going to be the sequel, if this does well.
Sam Brooks, for joining me for Padding. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
After the emotions and high-buffed jinx of the Golden Globes, the merry caravan of independent filmmakers heads for the hills, to Utah for the Sundance Film Festival, which kicks off this week. This year will be a particularly exciting one for British cinema, with 12 features in all from the UK on their way to the festival. Armando Iannucci's first foray into cinema, In the Loop, gets its US premiere at the festival. Dominic Murphy will be there with his debut feature, White Lightning. And Alexis Dos Santos takes a Latin look at East London with his film, Unmade Beds, which screens in the World Cinema section. So, to get a flavour of the world's most famous independent film festival and to what the British contingent can expect, I'm joined by Armando Iannucci, director, writer, actor, and, of course, observer colleague of mine. Welcome to Film Weekly, Armando. Have you packed your thermals yet, Armando? You're off to the snowy slopes of Utah. When are you going?
I'm going on Monday. I'm going from Leeds to Utah.
Well, there's not much to tell the difference between the two. What are you doing in Leeds?
It's the opening of Skin Deep, which is an opera I wrote the libretto for, and Opera North opened with it on Friday.
So let me get this right. You've polished off a little libretto that you're going to go and debut up at Opera North. Then you're going to go and attend the world premiere of your feature film debut.
Yes, it wasn't planned like that. I mean, I finished writing the libretto about 18 months ago. And then since then, obviously, that's when the music got written and the production got planned and designed and rehearsed. And it's just... Fortunately or unfortunately, the two have kind of coincided. So yes, I'm going from an opera to a film in 4 days.
Your feature film is about?
It's about it's set in the British and American governments at the time when the Prime Minister and the American President are very keen on a military venture in the Middle East.
Right, so I'm sensing a satire, a satirical edge, a scalpel-like edge.
It's sort of influenced by, but not trying to say that it is, the events of leading up to the invasion of Iraq about 4 or 5 years ago. But it's the implication is that it could all be happening again.
Yeah,
setting it in the present day rather than 5 years ago.
And it's called In the Loop. People who are fans of In the Thick of It on the television, can they expect a similar aesthetic, a similar vibe, a similar humour because it's you?
The same sort of tone, but I mean, the only character we've kept from that show is Malcolm Tucker, played by Peter Capaldi. You'll see one or two cast members from that show turn up in new roles in this film, but there's a whole new cast as well. Tom Hollander plays the Minister for International Development, and Gina McKee is his press officer, and then we've got an American, then you see the whole of the, there's an American cast as well who are like a parallel with the UK cast. So James Gandolfini is a sort of Pentagon general who not quite as effectual as he likes to think he is.
What are you expecting from Sundance, Armando? I mean, what have you heard? Have you been before? What are you trying to expect you in a hot tub?
I hear it's quite manic. I hear it's full on. I mean, from our point of view, we are going out taking it, hoping to pick up an American distributor. So we've already been previewing it to various people already, and you know, it's been great that the response has been so good.
I see you sitting in a hot tub with Harvey Weinstein, smoking cigars, drinking cognac.
Well, you hold that image in your head. I will probably not do that.
I bet you, if Harvey asked you to share a hot tub with him, you share a hot tub. That's my first rule of film business.
Really? Really? Yes. And has that happened to you? Or
it might do. I couldn't possibly comment. And the other thing I would say is that you're in good company with... There are 12 British films at Sundance.
Yeah.
That used to be there was no British interest in Sundance. Occasionally there was one that came through, like The Full Monty or The English Patient. Now there seems to be a kind of groundswell of good British indie talent as well.
And I don't know whether it is, with economic climate and so on, the big budget films are slightly rarer, and therefore over the years the British film industry has really perfected the technique of making films that have a voice and a spark to them, but on a smaller budget, and suddenly the atmosphere is such that sort of film suddenly takes on a higher profile. I've also noticed over the last couple of years just an appetite in America for British comedy.
Amanda, I wish you really the best of luck with it, and do let us know how it gets on. I sense a comic column coming on already.
Hey.
Best of luck with
all right.
In the loop.
Okay.
Cheers, Amanda.
Thank you.
For more information on the Sundance Festival, go to sundance.org/festival. And while you're online, why not join us on Facebook? Film Weekly Fans is the group. You can join people like Sabine Pallas from Italy, who wrote Greetings from Rome, another one of those places where one lives out of sync with Film Weekly, amongst other things. It takes months for films to be released in Italy. How can they be so cruel? However, when some of these gems, says Sabine, eventually make it here and they're shown in some obscure cine club, I can get an unsuspecting friend to come along with me and catch a movie with subtitles that you've mentioned here on Film Weekly. Coincidence or brainwashing? Keep up the good work, she says. I'm eagerly awaiting your show each week. Ciao, Sabine. Buongiorno, Sabine, say I. You can also catch me in The Observer this Sunday, of course, with my trailer trash column, or you can just come back to us on Film Weekly at The Guardian next week. Until then, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer, Jason Phipps, goodbye.